Well, hello, friends. Before we start, Titus O'Reilly here. And if you haven't already heard, we have a membership program, Bazaar Plus, where if you want even more from Sports Bazaar, you can get it. As a member, you'll get a weekly bonus podcast of Mick and I talking absolute nonsense. It's a lot of fun. You get access to all the past bonus episodes too. So there are plenty there. So if you've missed out on them and you want to hear them, becoming a member means you get access to all of that. You get behind the scenes access. We've got a fortnightly newsletter that goes out to members that I write every fortnight with all sorts of information in it. You get access to the members only chat room where we have lots of fun on there, lots of behind the scenes stuff. You can vote on future episodes and you get early access to any live shows that myself is doing or Sports Bazaar Live podcasts that are coming up this year. So tons of reasons. We'd love to have you as a member. Bazaar Plus, and the link is in the show notes.
It's Sports Bazaar.
Get into it.
Some of these stories you would say that cannot be true.
I'm fine to us.
The hunt for the weirdest.
This is madness.
It's a masterclass in how not to do things.
The most harebrained scheme I've ever heard.
Strangest.
Oh, wow. You can't make this up.
Things are only going to get more bonkers.
Most unbelievable.
The most genius thing I've ever heard. You say evil. I say brilliant.
Stories to ever occur.
An unparalleled array of deadbeats.
A mecca for colourful characters.
In the world of sport.
Had a taste for testicle soup.
Can I just stop you for a second?
Don't act like you've never done this.
Sports Bazaar.
Opened his mouth and a sparrow flew out. Slept face down with a compass to make sure that his head was pointing north. He hit so many sixes into the members that they retreat into the bar.
I better lie down after that.
It's time for the leaders of the hunt.
It's 10 cent beer night at the ball bar.
It's Titus O'Reilly and Mick Malloy.
Welcome to the latest episode of Sports Bazaar with me, Mick Malloy. And doing the heavy lifting as always, it's Titus O'Reilly. How are you, Titus?
I'm very well.
All right, where are we going?
This is going to be a fun one. Might be multiple episodes because there's so much.
How do you not know how many episodes it's going to be?
Because I'm an idiot.
But you haven't meticulously mapped this out. We just got it.
You know me, never meticulous. Yeah. No, I've mapped it out, but it'll be two, maybe three, depending
two,
on.
Two, maybe three. What's our biggest, FIFA?
America's Cup's our longest because we had seven. Yeah. FIFA was six. But you just know FIFA,
they'll
it's
be back.
Still writing.
They're not
it's
done.
Still writing itself.
That book it's is open.
It's not even close. Oh, as we, yeah. Well, I think we talked on a bonus episode, which our members would know. We talked about how they elected a delegate a few months ago who's literally in jail. So it hasn't changed.
The Olympics don't deliver. They did under Juan. Juan Antonio Samaranch, who was like the Olympic Sepp Blatter.
Yeah.
He ran a loose ship.
Yeah, well, Havelange, remember, who was Sepp Blatter's mentor, was on the IOC board as well and was close with Samaranch. So I reckon we might do Samaranch. We've got the Paris Olympics coming up.
I
think we're going to have some Olympic fun and games coming up later this
sure.
year.
Sure. All right. But stand by.
Today's all about hijinks, which you love.
Oh, I love this.
And we are going back to the 80s, basically, late 70s into the 80s. Mm. And we're going to Wimbledon, not tennis, soccer.
Football, Wimbledon.
The okay. Crazy Gang, they were called, and Vinnie Jones being their most famous member.
Well, I know Vinnie Jones, of course, who's segued beautifully into acting. He's kind of a Guy Ritchie go-to.
Yeah.
Always plays a hard nut.
Yeah.
He was pretty hard on the field, right?
Very hard. But the thing is, often people who, a lot of people listening might not know this story and you're in for a wild ride.
Mm. I have to say I'm not up to speed with this.
Well, a lot of people know Vinnie Jones, but Vinnie Jones didn't create the Crazy Gang. He's a product of the Crazy Gang.
Is he? The alumni.
He's more like he comes in later, but we're in for a wild ride. So let's get
crazy
started.
Crazy Gang. I don't know much. I'm feeling a bit of a Hanson Brothers vibe here.
Yeah, but if you're called the Crazy Gang, it's not going to be, oh, these guys are really chill, laid back, easygoing guys.
If you're in the Crazy Gang, there's going to be an onus at some stage to be
absolutely
crazy.
Absolutely, and they get it for a reason.
All right.
Wimbledon FC was the club, and it's based in, obviously, southwest London. People know Wimbledon from the tournament.
Yeah.
They were formed in 1889. And they moved to their stadium, which was called Plough Lane, in 1912. And they were an amateur team for a long time. So up to 1964-65 season, they were purely amateur.
Yes.
It's not a Liverpool or a Chelsea or a Man U. It is a purely amateur.
Yes.
No one's getting paid. They're not competing with anyone at all.
Are they in any division or is this they're not?
They're in a couple of low-level amateur leagues.
Yeah.
So they're not in the football leagues, you know, which for those who aren't into soccer, you and I have talked about this before. You also got the Premier League at the very top.
Yeah.
Then you got the Championship. League One, League Two, League Three. And then if you fall out of the football leagues because they have promotion relegation, you go into semi-professional level. And that's where Wrexham have been. The big story of Welcome to Wrexham and people across that story was about getting out of semi-amateur into the football league. So in 1964-65, they become semi-professional Wimbledon and they enter what was called the Southern League. They are not in the football leagues. They are not a professional side. They won the FA Amateur Cup in 1963. This is their biggest moment in their history up until this point. Now, when we get into the 70s, they start to get known as, for a semi-amateur team, they're punching well above their weight.
Right.
So they beat Burnley in the 1974-75 a season in the FA Cup. It's the first non-league team to beat a top-flight club in history.
Yeah, right.
So they start to, people start to say, oh, this team might be good enough to be in the football leagues. They then win the Southern League in 1975, 76, and again in 1977. And people are saying, this team is too good to be down in semi-professional. And people are saying they need to move up to the fourth division, which is the beginning of the football league.
How do you make that transition?
Well, now it's an instant promotion based on results. So, you know, Wrexham won their league, which then promoted them into the football league.
So you can still be relegated out of the league
and
altogether.
Now you still can be relegated out of professional if you finish. They've changed
it.
It used to be Division 4, Division 3, Division 2, Division 1, and Division 1 was the top.
It was the top
That's
tier.
Been renamed into Premier League now, but this is back in the day before that. So to enter into the league in those days, though, it wasn't automatic. So they've won 3 years in a row their league. And today they would just go straight up. But back then you had to be voted in. So someone had to come out. So it had to be a board meeting and the Football League would vote someone out of the league.
Based around performance.
Them being terrible, bad crowds, all that sort of stuff.
So that would be a factor in the vote.
Oh, absolutely. Like you had to be seen to be able to not only be a match on the field but be...
Have enough infrastructure and all that. Teams.
Yeah, you're coming up to bring professional. No longer are you semi-professional.
It's like an audition.
So the chairman at the time was a guy, he was the owner as well. He was a guy called Ron Nodes, and he'd purchased them in 1976 for £2,800. So this is well before, because you know now it's like you've got to be an oil sheik or a Russian oligarch.
That's right. You need to be an oligarch owner.
Back then it could be, you know, you could own a car dealership and you could probably buy a football team, especially at the lower end like this, right?
Yeah, gotcha.
He starts a campaign to get them in. It's a PR campaign, but he's also hitting up the football league saying, we should be in. Can you get us in? He put together this special brochure that's sent to the Football League showing all their facilities and their crowds and everything and why they should be in. And one of the things he did is the photo said, here's a picture of an evening game, and underneath he wrote, an evening game at Plough Lane showing the quality of the floodlights, right? Now, he said later on, the floodlights were crap. So I wrote it in a way that when he said showing the quality of the floodlights, it could be read as
interpreted
the
quality any way you like.
The quality is terrible.
What was the intonation?
Yeah, but he said, so I was just lying, right?
Yeah.
Total held together with sticky tape club at this point. So one of the defenders, Dave Donaldson, he had signed for £14 a week. He had a well-paid job as a senior systems executive at British Airways.
Yes.
So they had organised with British Airways that his timetable – of when he had to work would fit with the fixture. So they were just doing anything to get guys to be able to play. You
this is like, resourceful stuff.
It was resourceful, but it was also, to give you an idea how broke they were, they had no money. I mean, one, they can be bought for under $3,000, but one time they're trying to board a bus or to an away game and the coach driver locks the door and they won't let them in. And then bang on the door, the players, he says, you can't get in. I haven't received any of my money for my previous trips driving you guys around.
Now, where have we heard this before?
This was
Jimmy White.
Jimmy White.
Jimmy White.
So it's very similar.
Favorite stories.
So they call down Ron, the chairman and owner, and say, he won't let us on. So he's to write a check out there and then for all the back stuff. So
slip it under the door.
Yeah.
Shh, door's open. Shh. Shut.
Another time when they did have a bus, they went to Swansea to play an away game and they stopped at a service station to fill up the bus and they accidentally left behind a player, Dave Galvin, and they just drove off without him. and he didn't play the game. So they're like, they're total amateur hour right at this point. They used to steal traffic cones from the nearby freeway for their training.
Mate, this is terrible.
So Rondo desperate to get in the Football League. He spends $3,000, which is more than he
paid for the club.
Wimbledon were called the Dons. Dons for Division 4 PR campaign he paid. One stunt involved getting Tony Greig, who is currently the England cricket captain, to be a director. So a bit like they did with Uri Geller. and Michael Jackson, you know, that episode.
Tony
Greig,
that's a good call, though.
It's a good call.
It's got to draw a fair bit of attention. And
exactly.
I mean, he's probably the most high-profile sportsman in the
in
country.
England,
England
at the
captain
time.
Of yeah. the test team. Get the lion on the line. Remember he did those ads for Kerry Packer?
And he did the pitch reports, of course, in Australia for years.
Pitch reports. He'd stick a key
in the cracks, yeah. Bring back. That was great stuff.
Yeah, it was. First player to wear a helmet.
Right.
It was World Series cricket. He came out with basically a motorcycle helmet, like he'd ridden a Vespa to the ground.
Yeah, yeah.
And then just walked on.
We've got to do World Series cricket at some point. But they had the drop-in pitches for the first time.
Yeah, they
did. And they were so hard that the ball would just bounce way more than it ever had before and faster. And so it broke Hooks's jaw.
Yes.
And so that's why the helmet got invented, because of the World Series cricket and the drop-in pitches. But I always liked the story that the box to protect your wedding tackle was invented in the 19th century.
Yes.
And it took till the 1970s to men to think of putting on a helmet.
We got the essentials covered. I can wear one in the noggin.
Exactly.
But I'm not. Well, here you go. Tony Greig, so that's a good call, I reckon.
Well, I think he was also a fan of the club. So they had all these, you know, they're doing everything to say, we're winning on the pitch. We've won 3 years in a row and we've got Tony Greig now. And here are our floodlights of a certain quality. And meanwhile, they can't afford buses, all right?
Right.
So at the annual general meeting of the Football League on the 17th of June 1977, which was at the Café Royal in London, it was announced Wimbledon would take the place of Workington in the fourth division. They got 27 votes compared to Workington's 21.
Is it like electing a pope? Like
conclave? Oh yeah, all the key people who run the Football League get together and various clubs have votes and they're all chairmen of other clubs and stuff and they all vote.
And can you lobby at that actual meeting all the hard work before?
I think they present at the meeting too, but they've done a lot of the lobbying and glad handling and, you know, bringing Tony Greig to lunches and they're doing everything.
So they're not all sitting there like they're about to award the Olympics to a country or something like that.
It's a bit like that in that there's a vote. So it is more like a Pope enclave.
Yes.
I don't know if a bit of smoke goes.
A bit of smoke is released.
They should bring that into sport.
Wouldn't that be great?
Oh, it'd be great. It'd be fantastic.
Like a gender reveal. they're just the colour of the smoke is the. Oh, it's Wimbledon green.
So Wimbledon are suddenly in. Now, Alan Batsford had been the manager. He falls out with Nodes 6 months after this vote and he got replaced by a guy called Dario Grady as the manager, right? Mm. At the same time they've become professional, they're getting ready to play in Division 4. They've done it. They're going to become fully professional. And they've had a guy at the club for a couple of years. He's an apprentice and he gets signed as their first ever full-time proper professional.
Oh, yeah.
His name is Wally Downs. Wally becomes the founder of the Crazy Gang. He's the spiritual guru of it. Everything about what's to follow begins with Wally.
And he's their first.
He's their first professional
signing.
He's signed by Wimbledon as a 16-year-old. He was playing for West London Boys. And even as a 16-year-old, they know he's not yet a full professional at this point. At 18, he becomes a full professional. There's a few years before they're in the Division 4. He was known to have no fear with other older players.
Right.
This was when there was initiations, players, like, you know, younger players had to clean the older players' boots, all stuff that doesn't happen anymore, right? And from earliest days, he was someone who showed no fear whatsoever and also was known for his pranks and just general mucking around, right? He ended up playing 207 games for Wimbledon between 1979 and 1988. So he goes on to be a great player. Breaks his ankles quite a few times, so misses a lot of games.
Right.
But is the key guy there for a long part of this run. They used to get these long train journeys to places like Rochdale and Halifax, and there was no exclusivity in that there was no player's carriage or anything. All the fans who went with the team to the away game would come back with them. Right?
Yes.
So they're all in the same carriage. And Wally loved this, right? They would drain the buffet car dry. They would drink all the beer and spirits and wine every time on the way back. They'd just no holding back. They'd have a sing-along, whether they'd won or lot. Then they'd continue on. They'd get the coach from the train station and drink on that. Then they'd arrive at either the Sportsman Pub, which the club owned, or there was a nightclub in the stands.
At the ground
called Nelson's, and they would all get hammered there.
Right.
So huge drinking culture, right? One time after a reserve team game, Wally's on the bus and the bus stops for fish and chips. And as the bus takes off and they're all driving, everyone's finished their fish and chips. Wally gets the box of chips and puts it on the driver's bald head. Right. Wally said there was still odd chips and bits of batter in the box, so his head started to burn. We're hurtling down the motorway at 70 miles an hour and he's forced to make an emergency stop. He then orders everyone out, leaving us stranded on the hard soldier, and then he quits, and so they'd have to walk off.
Drive off?
He drove off. He just
left the whole team on the side of the road,
right?
A bit of time to think about.
Wally loves this stuff. Another time, and everyone suspects it was Wally, there was a radio news report that they saw someone, a player, naked on top of the minibus while the minibus was driving around town. Right. They'd do all this hazing and making fun. It was like you either sunk or swim. You arrived at the club, they would mock you mercilessly. Yeah. If you could take it, you were one of them. Yeah. If you didn't, you were out. So defender Dean Thomas arrives. He's got a mustache and a side parting. So Wally nicknames him Adolf Hitler.
And he's just a playful nickname.
He becomes known as Adolf Hitler.
Here comes Adolf Hitler.
Yeah. So they just think this is great fun. Right.
Did he change his hairstyle at all?
No,
Wally
said they used to call him Adolf Hitler, and he'd say, "Why? Where's the resemblance?" And they're going, "You got a mustache and a comb over, mate. Like, it's, you look exactly like him." And he's going, I don't see it. And the more he's like,
"You're wearing jodhpurs."
Like, yeah, you keep goose stepping everywhere. And the more he did that, the more he denied it, the more they just loved it, right?
Oh, that's like, it. You've taken the bait.
Yeah, you've taken the bait, right?
I've got you.
Now, another young player called Alan Cork joins, and he had an Austin Allegro, which is, you know, an old car, you know, and it kept breaking down. Oh. And he tells Wally this. He goes, "Oh, God, this car keeps breaking down. I want a new one. Like, this is ridiculous." So Wally goes, "Oh, I reckon I know how to fix this."
Oh, yeah.
So they drive it somewhere remote.
Wally's up to no good.
And Wally says, "We'll set it on fire and you'll get the insurance. And then you buy a new car." So they try and set it on fire. Doesn't work. They go back, set it on fire. They're trying for an hour to try and get this car to light. They try and put a bit of paper in and light the paper into the petrol. And they run away as they light it. And then it does nothing happen, so they keep going back and relighting it and going back. And Wally says one time they light it, they go back, it doesn't light, so they all start walking towards the car, and as they're about to reach the car explodes.
It's just not thought through. Wow.
So they just knock about guys who just – there's no thought to consequences in anything they do. One night they get put up at a nice hotel just by chance before a game, and Wally starts filling bins with water and flooding the rooms of his teammates under the door.
Oh, my God.
This stuff starts to spread. Like, because Wally starts all these things, others, so they later on that night flood Wally's room.
Oh, of course.
And then he goes and complains to the manager. And they have this meeting where they're going, "Why'd you flood Wally's room?" And they go, "Because he flooded all of ours." And the manager's like, "Oh, fair enough."
Everyone go to your rooms.
And another player, Glenn Hodges, who joins, he's a really good defender for them. One day he's so furious with the ref, he spends the dying moments of the game trying to knock the ref out. But every time the ball goes to him, he tries to kick it at the ref. This ends up in kicking off a massive brawl.
Yeah.
So they're all loving it. A guy called Derek French joins the club as the physio.
Yeah.
You got to remember, they got no money. Sure. The reason they knew him is he was a local cab driver that they often used.
Yeah.
And they said, do you want to become our physio? Now, this guy wasn't trained as a physio. No.
And that would have been a late night discussion, yeah. I'm guessing, yeah, on the way home from a...
Let's get Derek. We like him. So they get Derek. He'd been this cab driver, and he said, making the transition from being a bad cab driver to a bad physio for me was easy because I was bad at everything. So he Love joins, it. And they do a pre-season tour of Finland, right? During it, they're on a boat crossing over somewhere, and Wally grabs French and puts him over the edge of the boat, holding onto his ankles to see how long he can hold his head underwater. Another time, another player called Roy Davies is having a drink with Wally on the train back from a game.
Sure.
Wally says, after we get off the train, do you want to get off and go and get have a big night out? And Davies goes, I can't. I've got to get home to the wife.
Yeah.
And Wally goes, okay, I reckon I got a plan. So the plan was that they would say Davies had been hit.
I'm going to burn his car and get off. I don't know. What's the plan?
Their plan was they would say Davies had been hit by a can thrown by a Halifax fan and was concussed. So they get the physio, Derek French, to bandage his head up. They go to London. They go into a pub. He keeps the bandages on all night. They yes. get absolutely written off. At 2 o'clock, they get a cab back to Davies' house. And they... in the cab and throughout the night, they've gone through the story numerous times, right? Which was, you got hit by a can, you got concussed, you slept on the train, we got back to the ground, our home ground, you had a couple of beers and we just checked you all right and that's why you're late home,
yeah.
right? And they drilled him like 40 to the times, story. Right? So they walk into the house at 2 a.m, the wife comes down and says, where the F have you been? And the whole story just goes out the window. Davies panics and starts telling her the whole story. Wally came up with this idea, and Wally said the worst about it is the whole time he's telling her, he's unwrapping the bandage, and the bandage just keeps unraveling for like what feels like an hour because it's just so long. And the guy's just complete. Wally's furious. Like he's going, this
he's left Wally high.
Yeah,
dry.
Wally's going, this story is.
You don't abandon ship.
Yeah.
You stick to the story.
Yeah. Wally's like, now I'm. So then Wally goes home. And Davey's wife has rung her, his girlfriend at the time. When he gets back, he goes, I got it in the absolute neck from the missus. She blamed me for leading him astray. And then Wally said, these were fun days, happy days.
But he wore the bandage all night.
Yeah, it was.
Then he just folded.
Folded.
Character.
Straight away.
It would have been easy to pull off.
Yeah. Yeah, it could have been. Are you okay? Oh, my God. Thanks for bringing him home, guys.
Woozy. Yeah, a bit woozy. If anything I says doesn't make sense,
yeah,
I better lie on the couch.
Yeah.
Can you give me a beer?
You could you could even like, you know, if there's holes in the story, you go, I can't really remember, what happened after
that. You've got the absolute out.
Yeah, Wally's
I'm
come
sorry,
up with
a
great.
It's all a bit hazy to me, to be honest.
Yeah, Wally's come up with a great story.
Wally's come up with a masterpiece.
In fact, you and I might be trying, Matt. I hope our partners don't listen to this.
I'm writing this down. That's what I'm doing.
So Down says it was just a great culture, but it did make everyone mentally tough. He said it was very, very tough love. You know, only the strong survived.
Correct.
So in the 77-78 season, they're first in the fourth division. They finished 13th. Which was a good start because some people are expecting
that's
them
right?
to drop, right? Yeah, so it's like not bad, and they're happy with that. Their manager, Dario Grady, he's identified that they got no money.
They would get more coin coming in surely with stepping up.
Yeah, still not because they attract Plough Road, the stadium, is awful and it only fits 10,000 tops and they're pulling like 2,000 a game. And this is before all the money came in through TV rights. And so your gate was a big part of it.
Sure.
And they were a small club. Like they weren't bringing in much money even with going up to Division Four, right? Like it wasn't much better for them. So he sets up basically what's a youth academy. And this is before youth academies
were a thing.
And this is going to help them out immensely down the track, right? The next season they finish second in the fourth division. They miss out on the top just on goal difference, and this means they're promoted to Division 3.
Wow.
So they're suddenly now moving up. The 1980 season, they don't do well at Division 3. They win just 10 games. They finish last and they go back down to Division 4.
Mm.
The next season, they start to improve again. They're too good for Division 4, so they go back up to Division 3. Off the field, it's a mess, though, because Ron Nodes, the owner, he starts getting in talks to move the club out of Wimbledon to Milton Keynes, which is, you know, it's a bit like Canberra. It was after the war, named after the economist Milton Keynes. Yeah. It was set up as a city from scratch.
Yes.
So designed from scratch. It's seen as a bit of a plastic city in a way. But they don't have a club and he wants to move them there. This doesn't work. This falls over. The fans find out, they're furious and everything. So he sells up and he purchases Crystal Palace, which is nearby. And the first thing he does is he pinches Dario Gradi, the manager, and takes him with him. So suddenly Wimbledon, they are back up.
He's robbed the joint on the way out.
Yeah, he's robbed it. His last act as owner is to appoint the assistant manager, Dave Bassett, to the position of manager. This proves it to be the moment that basically changes everything.
Okay.
Right? Bassett, who's called, his name's David Bassett, but everyone calls him Harry. I couldn't find out why.
Don't know.
So Harry Bassett.
Yeah.
Some players would come to the club who were potentially being recruited and they'd sit down and he'd say, "Hi, I'm Harry." And so they'd sit down and chat to this bloke the whole time waiting for David to arrive. He joined Wimbledon in 1974 as a player. He'd had a long career as a semi-pro, so never a great player. Yeah. He was a tough midfielder. Dirty would be how his opponent would probably describe him. But while he wasn't a great player, he was fanatical about winning.
Yeah,
right?
Sure.
He was really driven. The game gets past him, so that's how he becomes the assistant manager. He runs the reserve team and then suddenly he's the manager. And he brings to this team this fanatical work ethic, starts bringing in all these new innovations. So suddenly he gets their fitness up. There's these long runs all the time through forests.
Here we go.
It's like really full on, like training.
I'm hearing the Chariots of Fire music theme.
Yeah.
This is the montage.
Yeah, and this is when most football clubs just played 5-on-5 at training and that was it. He was making them run and run and run and
run.
He also got a stats man, Neil Lanham, who would sit in the stands for every game and record everything, kicks, corners, long throws, but also the movement of the ball and in the build-up to goals and stuff like that. This was kind of unheard of. So he was doing Moneyball well before there was Moneyball. You know, he was doing this thing of using the data to find secrets and ways of improving that other clubs weren't even
working.
There was a new owner who we'll get to. He convinced him to spend £11,000, which is a lot of money at the time.
Big coin. That's the biggest figure I've heard bandied around today.
Yeah, and this is in the early 80s on video equipment so they could record all their games and they would get tapes of other teams even from Europe and they would study them and they would study opponents and they were doing this well before anyone else was really doing it.
Okay.
Before that, Wally had explained this is how they used to record games. He said, this is Wally's quote, "We had a fat goalkeeper who was called the Flying Pig." He was in the reserves and his dad was a sergeant at Wimbledon Police Station, so he used to use the police's CCTV cameras to film matches and training.
Hilarious.
So Bassett brings all this professionalism on the field, but the other thing he decides is to create a strong team culture. He decides the best way to do this is create complete chaos. So he sees Wally as key to everything.
An agent, a chaos agent. Okay,
he loves hijinks and mucking around and pranks.
So on the one hand, he's data-driven and he chronicles everything and he's meticulous.
And training is elite.
And then on the other hand, he's encouraging a bit of madness. He's a genius.
He's like, the more they bond and the more they do all this stuff to each other, the more they become a team, but they also become tougher mentally and all this sort of stuff. Yeah. So he loves it, right? Practice matches were concluded with a game called Harry Ball, which was a player who had to dribble through several grids with the ball, and the rules were that there were no rules. Like the players could do anything to each other. One game ended with a senior player with two broken ribs.
The flying pig involved?
Yeah. They used to play British Bulldogs.
Oh, my God.
After training.
That's the end of it.
That's the end of it. So he loved all of this. Now, at one point, they signed a new player, and French the physio is walking with Bassett, and they're all having a big night out. And they see the new recruit fall into the bushes because he's so pissed. And French turns to Bassett and said, "He's one of us."
He's got what it takes. Yeah. He's got the right stuff.
Yeah. So they're all into like boozing together, hijinks, all this. For instance, once Bassett had decided to attend a post-match press conference completely naked and sat behind the desk.
Is that the coach?
He's the coach. He's the manager. And all the players go, "We don't even know why he did it. He just did it to make us all piss
ourselves." Was it after a win or a loss?
It was after a win. He just turns up naked. Right?
Fantastic.
Yeah, he'd get angry and scream at players. Once Glenn Hodges, the defender, was sent off in a reserve match and Bassett wanted to call him the C word and was yelling so much he called him a fat, petulant cake. Misspoke and called him a fat, petulant cake. So his nickname becomes the cake.
I was going to say, that's going to stick.
So he becomes the cake. Okay. Another time they stopped the minibus, again for fish and chips. And Wally gets off and so does another player, Stephen Parsons. And Bassett then immediately, while they're in ordering the fish and chips, orders the bus to drive off, leaving them stranded in East London.
Fantastic.
Right? The next morning, Wally and Steve Parsons are first in at training and they storm into Bassett and they go, "What the hell?"
Yeah.
And Bassett goes, "It's got nothing to do with me, mate. All the young players like Glenn Hodges, Paul Fishton, Kevin Gage, Mark Morris, they made the driver move on. I had nothing to do with it." He says, "The next thing I hear was squeals from the dressing room as both Wally and Steve took revenge. I loved it. It was bonding Bassett style." So he's just like totally messing with them,
that's
right?
Unbelievable.
If it was your birthday at the club and you were training, you'd get jumped on and stripped naked and left to make your way back across six fields of dog walkers.
Happy birthday.
Yeah, so they'd take you for a run, they'd jump on you, strip you, and then you'd have to walk across these six fields.
That's sweet.
The locals were so used to it, they'd look at the naked man walking across and go, "Oh, look, it must be his birthday."
Happy birthday. Everyone just starts.
Yes. So he often wouldn't order them to do pranks against each other, but he would tacitly, like, no one ever got punished.
Yeah.
Right. If someone went to him and said, "The guys like did this to me," he'd go, "Oh, okay.
Well, how are we going to deal with that?"
He'd go, "Okay. Sounds like you need to." He also didn't mind if they did pranks to him, though.
Mm.
So there was one time he wouldn't allow his players out the night before a final game, even though the league had wrapped up. It was the last game that didn't mean anything.
Yes.
They said, "Come on, Gaffer, can we go out for the night?" He said, "No." And he knew they'd retaliate, right? So the next morning he goes in and he finds his shoes are filled with deep heat. Right, this is before the game. And he's like, laughs and doesn't put the shoes on, right? And he's like, "You got to get up early in the morning and catch me." So he gets into his tracksuit and his train top and everything and he goes out onto the touchline. The game starts. And 15 minutes into the game, he feels a slight tingling sensation around his nether regions. And then it becomes more and more intense and it's getting hotter and hotter and he's hopping around and itching and the players are all laughing while the game's on. He says, "My knackers were afire," right?
It's so juvenile.
It turns out the players had got up early. They put the boots out as a decoy knowing he'd be suspecting something and knowing he'd find it. And then they got his jock strap and covered that with deep heat.
Fantastic.
Another occasion, the players are staying at a hotel and they got Bassett's bed while he was out and threw it in the swimming pool. Now, the funny thing about this is why they were all horrible to each other in many ways and doing all this stuff. A goalkeeper joins. He was a young guy and his name was Dave Besant and he went on to a great career both at Wimbledon and elsewhere, right?
Yes.
Becomes one of the great goalkeepers. But he's recruiting as a young kid and it's his debut. And he's inducted into all this stuff, right?
Right.
Like the nakedness, the deep heat, all this. They always were like, they'd hide your keys. If you left your keys somewhere, they were gone. Yeah, like, so he's had all this initiation and he thinks, these guys are psychotic. I hate it here, right? He makes his debut. They're winning 1-0 against Blackpool. and he lets in the easiest shots. It was so lightly hit. It went between his legs, doesn't even roll to the back of the net. And he's like, it's 1-1 and they draw and they would have won. And he's like, these guys are going to kill me and my professional career is over because it's his first professional game. He goes back to the locker room expecting them to all give it to him. No one says anything. And then they say, come to the pub. And he goes, okay. And he goes to the pub and they all gather around him and go, we think you're great. We think you're going to be great. That was just a stuff up today. Forget about it. We are going to get you so paralytic now and just have a big night out. And that's what they did.
Fantastic.
And so he was like, so it worked in a way, right? It was like they weren't just like going out of their way to be horrible. It was
the
like,
underlying sentiment of that is fantastic.
Yeah. So the guy that's bought the club after Nodes is a guy called Sam Hammond. And Sam Hammond, he'd grown up in Beirut in Lebanon.
Right.
This is in the 50s and 60s mainly, when it wasn't the war-torn place it was now. It's doing quite well. He'd graduated from the American University of Beirut with a degree in civil engineering and he'd gone into the construction trade. And at the time, from the 60s through the 70s, Beirut, when he starts working as an engineer, there's a building boom. Right?
Yes.
It's really going off. So the opportunities are huge and he's smart enough to go straight into contracting. He's got a business.
Yes.
He's doing all that sort of stuff and there's these huge projects being built. Abu Dhabi in the United Arab Emirates, he works on a major airport and he's doing that. That makes him millions of dollars. So suddenly he's got money. Yeah. He's then doing other building projects across like, you know, all the oil money's there. He's making money hand over fist. In one of them, he's an engineer on a palace for an Arab prince. They need sand, but it's in the middle of the desert, but it's the wrong kind of sand.
Yeah, gotcha.
He gets paid to just ship all the sand in. And he said, I made a lot of money from that one, I can tell you. So people start saying, this is a guy who sold sand
to the desert.
To the desert, right? He was like shipping
desert dwellers. Yeah.
So he becomes known as an incredibly canny businessman, right?
Yeah.
In 1975, though, he's got one kid, another on the way, and in Beirut in April of 75, a full-scale civil war breaks out between the Christians and the Muslim factions. The Israelis invade. There's a war going on there for the next 16 years. It devastates Lebanon. For him and his young family, he's got to decide what to do. He's got this huge company, but he's like, is it worth it? So he decides, I'm going to cash out all my businesses and I'm going to move to London. And he picks Wimbledon because he likes tennis.
Right, yes.
He turns his eye to this football club and he's read about it and stuff and on almost a whim he decides to become a shareholder, not the major shareholder at first. And they put him on the board because he's a shareholder and this gives you an idea when he joins how poor they are. The Supporters magazine write about him and since his appointment to the board in early January, he has become increasingly popular with everyone. Two visits to the Supporters Club shop resulted in an extravagant spending spree which went well into three figures. Three figures.
Wow. There's a whale in the house.
Yeah. So this is like what it's like, right? When Noakes decides to go buy Crystal Palace, he decides, all right, well, I'll buy it all, right? You'd think he's the owner and the chairman. He's the steadying hand because he's got Wally and he's got Bassett.
Don't tell me he's a prankster too.
So on train trips back from away games, he once started throwing things around the carriage and ended up with all the players involved in a fight. He ended up on the floor wrestling with all the players. So he's as nuts as they are.
This is a great
and
club.
Just loves it, right? He also did odd things in contracts. He insisted on a clause in a player's contracts, every player that joined the club now he owned it. If they lost by more than four goals, or if they lost by four goals, they would have to sit through a five-hour German opera.
Oh, wow, that's playing hardball, that is.
So
once
they had to all do it, the whole team had to go sit through a five-hour, which these guys who, let's be honest, they've got attention deficit problems, them sitting through
five. If they're not dacking someone in a paddock.
Yeah.
5 hours of a German opera.
Yeah.
Jeez.
He later inserted a clause that the players would have to eat, if they lost by four goals, sheep's testicles, which was a delicacy that he was always foistering on people, right? So that was another one he had. He was trying to sign a player called Robbie Earl, and Robbie said to Robbie, come over to my house and we'll chat. And Robbie Earl's not sure. So Hammond locks him in the dining room and refuses to let him out until he'd signed. And he says, if you sign, I'll give you the key. but if you turn down the offer, then they're hidden in my underpants, so you'll have to come and find them.
Go for a rummage.
So he ends up signing. So he joins.
So it's the players, the coach,
and the owner,
Are all nutbags.
And he's happy as owner even to be at the end of things, right? So the players used to get stuck into him and do pranks on him all the time, and he loved it. He loved being one of the boys. They would often rip up his suits and cut them up with scissors if he took them off and was in something else. They would often throw him and his suits. If his kate turned up in a nice suit, they'd throw him into a puddle. And he'd laugh. There's pictures of all this, right? Yeah. It's hilarious. He would creep into his own team's dressing room before the games, before they'd arrived, and scrawl outrageous insults about them on the walls to motivate them. And one time another team found these before the game and got all angry because they didn't know who'd written them and everything. And
About
what he'd written on all the things, because some young kids saw them and they were apparently quite fruity. And he said, no one was ever, he goes, I didn't write them. And then one of the guys goes, you borrowed my pen. So it was all like, you know, he would also often throw their playing kits in the freezing cold bath before the game. So they'd have to wear them freezing cold just to fire.
See, that's not going to help your game. I'm all for pranking.
I know.
But I go, I'm not going to play at my best if I'm freezing to death on the.
Exactly.
They don't know where to draw the line, these guys.
Exactly.
I mean, it's funny. Don't get me wrong. Yeah, you could be sitting in the stand watching your team shiver.
Yeah.
You'd get a laugh.
Yeah.
And then they're going to lose by four goals. Then they're going to have to watch a German opera.
It wasn't all, it wasn't, not every psychological trick worked.
He's got game, this one. This
guy. So you've got the owner, a manager, and you've got Wally Downs as the ringleader of all of this, right?
Here
so you've got this set-up culture of mayhem. The 982 season, they get relegated back to Division 4. They're just not good enough for Division 3. They're yo-yoing back and forth. And it really leads them to try and have a big think about everything they're doing on the pitch.
Yes.
They don't think at all about what they're doing off the pitch, let me be very clear.
They're happy with that.
They're happy with that. But they're like, are our tactics right? What are we doing? We need a change. And we might wrap it up there because when we come back, they're going to carry out one of the most extraordinary runs in the history of English football of all time.
Wow. All right. I cannot wait. You've salted the mine for me. That is amazing. I'm enjoying this story. I love this club. And I really hope it pays off. I'd like to think that a hijinks pranks-driven philosophy has dividends. All right, Titus, I'll rejoin you for the conclusion of this story.
If you're interested in more of Mick and I talking complete and utter nonsense, we have the Bazaar Plus members program. If you love Sports Bazaar, this gives you an extra weekly bonus podcast on top of the one you get anyway. You get access to all those previous bonus podcasts as well. You get a newsletter every fortnight. You get access to the chat room. You get the ability to vote on future episodes as well. And importantly, you get early access to any live shows we're doing. You get that before everyone else. If you're interested, the link is in the show notes.